listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
I'm Rob Daly. This is your European football podcast, looking at all the major stories from Spain, Germany, Italy, France and more. My co-host is Chris Parrott.
Yep, and what's been a difficult week across the continent, the 24 for Euro 2016 are confirmed. We discuss who to avoid in next month's draw. It's an El Clasico weekend coming up, plus two of the biggest names in Serie A meet as they both try to maintain some sort of title challenge.
As Ireland qualify for UEFA Euro 2016, we speak to journalist Owen O'Callaghan of the Irish Examiner and Yahoo Sports, where we get the thoughts of Dutch football expert Peter McVitty about the fallout from the Netherlands failing to qualify for next summer's finals.
This is Football in Europe.
Well, that's the sound of Wembley Stadium in full voice singing La Marseillaise. Very kindly, football fan Pierre-Antoine Arlot allowed us to use the audio, his recording, from the game at Wembley Stadium. And Chris, what was a special night between England and France?
Yeah, it was. Football took a backseat. Emotional, poignant, defiant as well, wasn't it? The singing of the fresh national anthem, England fans joining in, there was a banner unfurled. Actually, almost as soon as the game was definitely on after those terrible attacks, this came out, let's all sing La Marseillaise together. It sort of become the symbol of standing up to terrorism, I think, in the last few awful days. And along with that French motto, liberté, égalité and fraternité, which couldn't be more relevant, I think, than now. That was around the edge of Wembley. The arch was lit up in the tricolour colours, as were most major landmarks across the world, actually. And in very difficult circumstances, it was a night when football, but also the French and the English public, I think, came together.
The Stade de France, of course, between that game and France and Germany, directly affected by the attacks. It was one of the areas that was attacked. And the players held up in the dressing room late into the night as they tried to make the area secure. And many players have been directly affected by what happened.
Yeah, they have. Antoine Griezmann's sister survived. She was in the Bataclan Theatre. Lassana Diarra's cousin, unfortunately, was one of those that was killed in it. Martin Kelly, the Crystal Palace defender, was actually in one of the restaurants as well. International break, he'd gone to the French capital. Amazing images of him helping some of the victims. So this was
extraordinary.
Yeah. And so many people were directly, or friends of friends, were impacted, including, as I mentioned, in particular for Diarra and Griezmann, that really personal link.
Diarra as well got a wonderful reception at Wembley when he came on in the game. Germany, the Netherlands, was called off late, 90 minutes ahead of the game. We'll talk about that later on. And Belgium, Spain was called off because of security concerns, and understandable as well. So a difficult time across the world of European football. France does host the European Championships, Chris, next summer. And while everything's been happening, there's been playoffs as well for the European Championships, and we now have the 24 teams who will be involved in France next summer.
Yeah, the last four sides to go through were via the playoffs. We had Ireland, of course, Hungary, Sweden and Ukraine were the last four spots. So here are the pots, all done on coefficient. Pot one, Spain as the holders, France as the hosts, Germany, England, Portugal and Belgium. Pot two, Italy, Russia, Switzerland, Austria, Croatia and Ukraine. Pot three, Czech Republic, Sweden, Poland, Romania, Slovakia and Hungary. And in pot four, Turkey, the Republic of Ireland, Iceland, Wales, Albania and Northern Ireland.
OK, Chris, so England are in pot one, along with France and Spain. Who do they want to avoid?
For me, I'll go pot two, Italy. Such a history, excellent players, tournament team. Pot three, Czech Republic, for me. They really came of age in a difficult qualifying group. They have some excellent players. But it's I know you disagree with me on that.
No, I think the Czech Republic are a great team. But I just think Poland are also a pretty good side. They beat Germany in qualifying. They have Robert Lewandowski. They have that individual quality. And while Sweden have Ibrahimovic, I think Poland have probably a better balance to the team. So from pot four, what would be?
Mine would be Turkey. I think I take your point about Lewandowski. They have great players like Arda Turan. They finished qualifying really well. Hakan Çalhanoğlu too is one of the most exciting young players. So from pot four, I'd say Turkey to avoid.
Okay, so you're going England, Italy, the Czechs, and then Turkey.
Yeah.
Oh, that would be a horrible group. I'd go Italy, Poland, and possibly Wales, given how impressive they were. Although you can't underestimate Iceland as well, because they were pretty impressive in a qualifying, and we'll talk about them later on in the show. If you are enjoying the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe to get every show. Firstly, though, the Republic of Ireland qualified for Euro 2016 with a famous win over Bosnia and Herzegovina. Two Jonathan Walters goals in Dublin saw Martin O'Neill's team get a 3-1 aggregate success. The morning after the result, I spoke to a very happy Owen O'Callaghan, a Dublin-based journalist who writes for the Irish Examiner, Yahoo Sports and the 42.ie.
You're listening to Football in Europe.
Owen, thanks for joining us on the podcast. What's the feeling like in Dublin after that win against Bosnia?
It's feel good and it's very, very positive. And what happened last night was right and it was fair. And we worked hard and we were determined and we were spirited. The opposition weren't. The objective from day one was to reach an expanded tournament. It was made slightly easier for a team of our calibre. It was almost expected. But it was a competitive group. You wouldn't really bet on Ireland in playoff situations. We don't have too much of a great history when it comes to knockout games like that. And I think everyone is just looking forward to France. They're just looking over to get there. In the immediate aftermath of the game last night, and with our thoughts still firmly in Paris with what happened on Friday night, every Irish fan instantly was talking about being there next summer.
I mean, I did lose faith in the possibility of Ireland qualifying, particularly after not just the defeat to Scotland, but the fact that they failed to beat Scotland at home. What was the temperature like then of Ireland's chances of qualifying for France?
Yeah, it was certainly worrying after that 1-1 draw with the Scots in Dublin. From four games against Scotland and Poland, Ireland managed to pick up 2 points from a possible 12. And that certainly was not good enough. We needed people to start doing us some favours. Ireland still needed to dig incredibly deep when everything was against them, particularly that game against Germany. There was question marks about Martin O'Neill. There was question marks about whether or not his career was essentially meandering and petering out. We were looking at the squad, we were looking at the players and thinking to ourselves, well, here's a genuine possibility that we're not going to qualify for an expanded tournament. Ultimately, they have now ensured that we've reached the promised land a little bit. Any child conceived in Ireland last night will either be named Martin or Roy if they're a boy. You know, last night was a great moment. The victory over Germany in Dublin was an equally joyous moment. Something similar last night. We need those moments that get everybody on side. Over the last number of years, there's been a distinct lack of those moments. And what Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane have certainly done, maybe in contrast to Giovanni Trapattoni, who also got us to a major tournament, this new kind of regime has ensured that we have these moments again. The streets of Dublin last night, in very, very similar to what happened after the Germany win, crowded with people. Streets were closed down. It was a party atmosphere. Everyone just felt so good. You know, life in Ireland has been miserable over the last number of years for various reasons.
You mentioned some new babies, maybe called Martin and Roy, but I suspect some may be called Jonathan as well, because Jonathan Walters has been a figure of derision at times in England in the Premier League. But I think there's a lot of respect for him now, particularly after his two goals. What are your thoughts on him as a player and what he's done for the national team?
I think he just typifies exactly what's missing from so many, you know, solid Premier League teams. He works tirelessly for a collective effort. There is no airs and graces with the guy. And you see that at Stoke. I mean, you know, how Stoke embroiled themselves in a contract standoff with a guy who's given them so much earlier on this season before finally kind of settling everything up and kind of coming to an agreement on a new deal. It was kind of beyond me. I mean, he's also got incredible footballing capabilities, as he showed last night. The coolness and composure to stick away a penalty, facing a goalkeeper who knows his penalty strategies probably fairly well in Asmir Begovic. But also the second goal, you know, across from Robbie Brady, whipped right across the 6-yard area. A little deflection kicks the ball up. He's probably got to align his body a little bit, and then he sticks it away via the inside of the near post. It probably looked a lot easier than it was. Martin O'Neill saying last night, you know, he really has been Ireland's player of this qualification campaign. As soon as the full-time whistle went last night, he went immediately to Asmir Begovic, his former teammate, to shake his hand and commiserate and say, well done, good game, mate. And then also he gave a post-game interview immediately after the full-time whistle, where he was very, very emotional. And that's as a result of his mum, who died a couple of years ago. He's gone on record as to say that every time he pulls on a green shirt, he thinks of his mum. And I'm just delighted that guys like them get their moment in the sun.
Owen, Martin O'Neill singling out Roy Keane for praise after the game. You know, I think people in England might not understand what level people like or what they think about Roy Keane now, given what happened at the 2002 World Cup. Has he gone some way to finding his way back into the hearts of the majority of the Irish fans?
I think Roy Keane has had a difficult relationship with Irish fans just over the last couple of years. I mean, if you cast your minds back to Euro 2012, he was very outspoken in his criticisms of Irish fans going over there and essentially enjoying themselves, having a bit of a knees up and enjoying the park, the atmosphere. A lot of Irish fans kind of had a problem with his perception of that. You know, what else do you expect fans to do when they're going and following a team at a major international tournament? It just seemed like Roy was at the peak of his kind of Victor Meldrew, moan a minute type persona. But ever since he's been brought in, as a member of the coaching staff, the perception's changed. I mean, he seems to be a lot calmer, I suppose, warmer. And you watched him last night on the pitch. Martin O'Neill and the coaching staff and everyone involved in the back room went out on the pitch because they were taking their own kind of lap of honour around the Aviva Stadium. And Keane was hell-bent on hanging back, you know, staying with Seamus McDonagh, goalkeeping coach Steve Guppy, and allowing Martin O'Neill to kind of take the rapturous applause from the crowd. And Martin O'Neill was dragging Roy Keane in towards the centre circle, almost getting him in a headlock to come with them. And, you know, Keane desperately trying to shake him off. It was quite funny, actually, to see it. No Irish team, for instance, under Giovanni Trapattoni, conjured as impressive as a performance as that last night. There wasn't the same level of camaraderie and support between the players and the coaching staff during the Trapattoni regime. All Roy Keane wanted was Ireland to be better. All he wanted was conditions to be better and everything to be improved. And that totally marries with the ideology of these players. You know, they grow up in a professional environment. They all play in, you know, football to a very, very high level. And here's this guy in their coaching setup who always wants them to be better than they are. Looking at Roy Keane with a smile on his face was something to behold. All you can say is that it's worked.
Let's just hope the training pitch is up to scratch in France, Owen, anyway. A quick one on Bosnia and Herzegovina. I interviewed Asmir Begic and Edin Dzeko in September of last year, just as the campaign was starting in Zenica. And it seemed the minimum objective was to qualify for the tournament. You've spoken to Begovic too. How disappointed will they be to not be part of the expanded format, do you think?
Yeah, I think they, you know, they went into 2014 World Cup. Many people had selected them as dark horses. They really just fell flat in Brazil. It was a difficult tournament. They changed the formation. And then that hangover kind of went into the early part of the Euro qualification campaign, where they had a miserable start. And then obviously Bazdarovic was brought in as coach. And because of their disappointments in playoffs in the past, those back-to-back playoff games against Portugal that they lost in 2009 and 2011, I felt they would be easily motivated. Instead of that, you look at these two playoff games against Ireland and you really have to scratch your head about how often they opened the Irish up, how many chances they created. Watching them in the second leg last night in Dublin, the ill-discipline was incredible. But, you know, they've got standout players, Bosnia. Unfortunately, sometimes those standout players just aren't enough for you.
Owen, thanks for joining us on the podcast, mate. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, man. A pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Football in Europe.
So the Republic of Ireland qualify for UEFA Euro again. Chris, they're joined by Hungary, who qualify for the European Championships for, this is unbelievable, for the first time since 1972.
And their first major tournament since the World Cup in 1986. It's been a massively long wait. They beat Norway 3-1 on aggregate, 2-1 second leg win. They put themselves in a great position by winning the first leg away in Oslo by a goal to nil. And a great goal scorer that fans like me of lower league football in England will... well, Tamás Priskin scored one of those goals, called it the best goal of his career, which upset me because I saw him score in the semi-final against Arsenal in the League Cup for Ipswich.
Oh, yeah. Was that when Cesc Fabregas started whinging about the pitch and stuff like
oh,
that?
Oh, not just the pitch. Oh, they play rugby. Cesc, we're Ipswich Town. Do you want us to try and play football against you? Don't be ridiculous. But Priskin was awful at Ipswich, but he did score a great goal against Arsenal at Portman Road. And he scored a according to him, an even better one. Massive goal for him and his country.
Yeah, they fully deserved it. And Balázsjak was their outstanding player on the night. They really wanted it, Hungary. I think that was the main thing. The crowd in Budapest were really up for it. And they are one of the 24 teams. We'll talk about the other playoff winners shortly, Chris. But let's look back to the the European Golden Boy.
You know, if you keep doing that, you might get on the shortlist for actually doing it when it's announced. You can come on stage and just do it.
Oh, wouldn't that be amazingly good?
Yeah, it would, yeah.
Oh, my God. Well, this is we mentioned this last week. It's a shortlist of the 40 best players under the age of 21 in European football. Some of the names, Chris, on that list.
Yeah, Dele Alli actually is on there. Not after his goal against France, but he's on there. Martial, Kingsley Coman, El Ghazi, Max Meyer as well.
Yeah, it's a good shortlist. So we've been asking you to tweet in using @FIEPodcast, who you think who is the best player under the age of 21. Some of these aren't nominated for the award, but here are your choices. Pete Farry says Ruben Neves, captained Porto in the UEFA Champions League. I think he was 18 and I can't quite remember how many days. Mark Rodden, who joins us on the show, the journalist, he says he's going to heap more pressure on young Yuri Tielemann's shoulders, but he'll calmly shrug it off and ping a 40-yard pass. And Jeff Waddle says the goalkeeper at AC Milan is in Donnarumma. He says, oh, but wait a minute, he's probably the best under-17 player in Europe at the moment at just 16 years of age.
Yeah, Adam Summerton, another Football in Europe podcast expert and regular, and the BT Sport commentator. Just checked the Bundesliga entrance. He says no Julian Weigl. ANW, which is at Ryan Miller 97. Hector Bellerin for Golden Boy. Surely he's become a vital player in the Arsenal squad. It's a very good point. And he certainly, I reckon, he's the quickest under 21 player. He's probably the quickest
Overton
player.
Stuart Overton tweeted in, say, Hector Bellerin as well.
Yeah, indeed. He says made himself indispensable. He's everything you want from an attacking fullback. I think he's got a good point.
David Cellini and both Adam Ridley go for Jose Maria Jimenez at Atletico, who isn't on the shortlist, I don't think. Charlie says Sergi Samper-Montagna for his appearances for Barcelona, a replacement for Busquets, he thinks. And Rob de Bank says Victor Fischer for Ajax, recently back from injury. Thanks for those. Keep them coming in using FIE Podcast on Twitter. Chris, let's have a quick chat about Michu. I remember seeing him play. I was at Stamford Bridge and he tore apart Chelsea, and I think it was the League Cup semi-final of the year they won it, and he scored. And in the press conference after, Michael Laudrup was saying, you know, he is a £30 million player, as has been talked about. But because of injuries and issues that might, I don't quite understand, he's dropped to the fourth tier of Spanish football. People may have seen this anyway.
Yeah, we both covered Swansea that season when he was outstanding under Laudrup.
I mean, he was one of the best players in the league. It wasn't just a fluke season. It seemed at the time he was.
Yeah, and I think his ankle troubles, didn't play much at Napoli, but was playing in the Champions League a year ago. As you mentioned, he's gone to the fourth tier now. Unión Popular de Langreo, they're managed by his brother. He's 29. They're in that fourth tier, as you mentioned, and you just wonder, can he ever get back to anywhere near the level he was? Such a shame, I think.
And his brother even said, you know, I hope he's not here too long because he should be playing higher. But the fourth tier of Spain isn't like League Two in England, is it?
No,
it's all regionalized into loads of leagues.
17 different groups. So you're talking a very low level. I mean, I'd go and watch him play just to see what he's like. It'd be like one of those, you know, one of those legends when they turn up as some sort of guest and they just rule the park in a five-a-side.
Yeah, if you're one of those who comes up against Paul Merson in one of those London leagues.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone that's played against Paul Merson for some reason. Chris, let's look at the other two playoff qualifiers quickly before we get Graham Hunter's thoughts on the young players at Barcelona ahead of El Clasico. So Ukraine and Sweden have qualified for the European Championships.
Yeah, they have. Ukraine 3-1 winners on aggregate against Slovenia. A bit of revenge. They lost in the playoffs ahead of Euro 2000, but they were 2-1 winners at home. Went to Maribor. Cesar scored early for Slovenia, and you thought this is going to be really good. It was very nervy, but Andrei Yarmolenko, basically with the last kick of the game, scored to make it 1-1 on the night. Ukraine went through 3-1 on aggregate. It's not been the calmest of qualifying campaigns. There's been the public not happy with the coach, etc. But Ukraine are there, and so is Zlatan Ibrahimovic. And Euro wouldn't quite have been the same without him, I don't think. And he was fantastic against Denmark.
Yeah, he scored two brilliant goals. The second, a free kick that he just bent into the top corner. It finished 2-2 on the night with Denmark. And that was a 4-3 aggregate win for Sweden. Those two late goals for Denmark anyway.
Yeah.
So Sweden were cruising.
You know, there's great footballing rivalry between those two Scandinavian nations in particular. Denmark won Euro on Swedish soil back in 92.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think terrific this Zlatan is there. Denmark will look at it, I'm sure, and think disappointed that they're not, that they didn't qualify automatically. And yeah, and the end for Morten Olsen, who's been in charge of Denmark since 2000. He was always said he was going to step down after Euro or the qualifying campaign. Only four coaches have ever had a longer reign in charge of a national team than him. 15 years? Walter Winterbottom's one of those, the legendary England coach in the 40s, 50s and 60s. But end of an era for Olsen. But yeah, Sweden, you only have to watch the celebrations to see how much it meant to them to make it to France.
And there was a good quote after from Ibrahimovic. He said, because it was talk that he was going to retire after the game if they didn't qualify. He said, Denmark tried to retire me, but I've retired their whole country or something like that. It's just absolutely brilliant from Ibrahimovic. So we'll be very happy to see him in France next year. Okay, let's look at the fallout from the fact that the Netherlands failed to qualify for the European Championships. It's a month since the Urania finished fourth, unbelievable, fourth in their qualifying group, failing to even reach the playoff round. Peter McVitie is a Dutch football expert writing for The Blizzard, Goal.com, Benefit, and 442 as well.
You're listening to Football in Europe.
Understandably negative outrage and a lack of understanding as to why the KNVB have messed up so much and why the national team haven't qualified for this tournament. It's really been an utter shambles, and it's all down to how they've reacted from finishing third in the World Cup in Brazil, which was unexpected, and they've kind of gone from there and taken it in the opposite direction. Everybody could see that Danny Blind, who was named as the successor to Chris Hiddink on the very day that Hiddink was unveiled as a successor to Van Gaal and part of this four-year plan, there was no indication that he was a good coach for anybody outside of the KNVB. He spent 1 year as a coach at Ajax about 10 or 11 years ago and failed. Once Hiddink left after a year in charge, things just got worse. Danny Blind's choices and his team selection were quite poor. He's kind of just carried on with the same mistakes that Hiddink did, and that was, well, not realising what mistakes you're making and completely changing the team around in the wrong way. So the fact that the KNVB are sticking with Danny Blind despite this atrocity that's happened and the Netherlands failing to qualify from a group which included the likes of Turkey and Kazakhstan and Iceland and Czech Republic is immense.
When people think of Dutch football, I think, Peter, they think 4-3-3, wonderful passing, attacking football. Have authorities and coaches in Dutch football been too stubborn to that ideology?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a crucial word, is ideology. The Netherlands have this need to play in a 4-3-3 and total football. But the problem is that other teams in international football and club football as well has developed beyond that and found a different way of playing and more rounded ways of playing. And Netherlands have been a bit too slow to adapt to that. Louis van Gaal's Netherlands team in the World Cup did something different. They set up in a 5-3-2, which morphed into a 3-5-2. It was quite a fluid and flexible system, which was built to mask the issues and the weaknesses in his squad, and it worked very well. As I say, they finished third in the tournament, even though there was a worry that they weren't going to get outside of the past the group stage. But instead of going for building on that route and saying, okay, we need somebody to succeed Van Gaal, let's go for someone like Ronald Koeman, who wants a job, who wants to leave his club, they opted for the old style, the attractive passing football. Let's go with Chris Hiddink and let's lay down this four-year plan. Hiddink and Blind, they'll carry it back to 4-3-3. That was the first thing Hiddink said when he was when he took over the team, was it's going to be a 4-3-3. And it was a disaster from the very beginning. None of it was attractive, none of it was effective, none of it was decent. So they've stuck by this religious idea of having to play this one way when world football's gone in a different way, in a better way.
Have they been too reliant on players who are into their 30s now, like the likes of Wesley Sneijder and Robin van Persie and Arjen Robben, despite the fact that there are lots of young players in the squad as well?
Yeah, certainly. I think you can't really help but rely on Arjen Robben. He's such a fantastic player. He's a wonderful dribbler. He's still one of the best in world football, in my opinion. That there's a kind of a lost generation of the Netherlands team at the moment. There's a group between the likes of Van Persie and Huntelaar, who are 32 years old, down to players like Memphis Depay and Jordi Klaassen and stuff, who are 21, 23, and that's an eight-year difference between Van Persie and Wijnaldum and Klaassen. And that's something that they have to deal with. But when you look at the players that they've got, they do have a lot of talent in the team. They do have very talented and exciting players. But the big problem that's going to come up now is that, well, Van Persie's international career is probably over. Huntelaar's is just about to come to an end. He's 32 years old. And they don't have a natural successor to that centre striking role. They have Baz Dost, who's the current kind of favourite to succeed them. You only really have Luc de Jong, who failed in Germany, went to England at the wrong time and is now back at PSV and is only just rebuilding his career and is not at that level. Beyond that, though, I don't think there's really a massive problem in terms of talent. I think they can build towards something good in the future. I think they have immense quality in young players like Van Dijk, like Kongolo, like Klaassen, Quincy Promise. Regi Le Bazour is one player that I'm a massive fan of, and Anwar El Ghazi, who I think can be one of the best in the world as well.
Peter, let's talk about Memphis Depay specifically. I can't help but feel he's had a bit of an unnecessary kicking, not just for his club, but for his country. I saw Manchester United play the other week and he was left out of the team again for Jesse Lingard, and he wasn't in the latest national team squad. I can't help but feel he's been a bit hard done by. And when I think back to when they lost away at Turkey, he was probably their main outlet for anything happening at all. So why is he not in the squad? Why are they not including him at what is surely a vital transition time?
Well, I'm happy that you mentioned that Turkey game, because that's the one that stood out to me, was that he was constantly putting really good crosses in and at good positions where either Van Persie wasn't and should have been. But after that game, Memphis was criticised for not being the player who grabbed them by the scruff of the neck and took them forward. And I found it really amazing that they had just completely overlooked everything that he'd done. You have to give him time. This is a kid who's 21 years old. His only experience is two full seasons in the Dutch top flight. Van Gaal believes in Memphis Depay. Memphis Depay believes in Memphis Depay. That's enough for me. Memphis's form at Manchester United wasn't fantastic. Obviously, it hasn't been. But a couple of months ago, he turned up at the national team to meet up with the national team, and he was wearing a hat and a scarf. I mean, Netherlands is cold. It's a cold country. I've lived here for 10 months now. I've experienced it's cold. So, I mean, people can wear hats and scarves, but he was criticised for this. People were saying that he was a pan flute. He looked like he was from a Peruvian pan flute band. People were saying he's a young guy who's shown up with a big ego. He looks flashy.
I interviewed Depay last year at Eindhoven, and I wonder, he is sure of himself, and I wonder if that element of his personality, because it comes across, whether people just take to it badly. I'm not saying that's right.
Yeah, but he has a right to be confident. I mean, he was built up from a young age to be a future star in the Eredivisie. He's got obvious talent. He wants to be one of the best in the world. I mean, if you look at him play, if you look at even the way he does talk about himself, he has immense belief, but he has the work ethic to back it up, to show that he has the skills and the determination, I think, to actually fulfill his dreams. When you're in a team with the likes of Van Persie and Huntelaar and Arjen Robben and Wesley Sneijder, and you're 21 years old, I find it quite rich that a country should be piling on the kid who's 21 years old and saying that you should be the one who's leading this team, you should be the one who's making a difference for this team.
Next time in the Netherlands, I'm going to wear the most flamboyant hat I can possibly find. Peter, thank you very much for joining us on Football in Europe.
Thanks for having me, cheers.
This is Football in Europe, La Liga latest.
Okay, Chris, let's turn our attention to club football for a little bit now. This weekend, it is what many consider to be the biggest game in club football around the world. El Clasico, Real Madrid host Barcelona on Saturday evening. And a lot of the talk ahead of this one is about the fitness of Leo Messi.
Yeah, as you'd expect, not played since September. It's been all that anybody in Barcelona has talked about since then, basically. He's in training. Will he play? Won't he play? Everyone's saying that he will. Some conspiracy theory saying, oh, maybe it's just a mess of Real Madrid's head. If he does play, how fit is he? They've been excellent without him. Of course, Lionel Messi improves every team, but Luis Suarez and Neymar have been outstanding in his absence, particularly recently. So it is all about Messi. Will he play? I think he probably will if he's back in full training, you'd expect. And you'd expect from the very start that this was the date that they'd looked at for his return, I think.
Barcelona topped by 3 points in La Liga. Do you think they can't afford to lose this game, Real Madrid? They have to at least take a point, with the fact it's at the Bernabeu as well.
Yeah, I think so. And in the goldfish bowl that is Madrid, it's probably quite a big game for Rafa Benitez after they lost to Sevilla for the international break. They're 3 points behind a Barca team now that hasn't had Messi, hasn't had Alex Vidal, hasn't had Arda Turan. They can't play until January.
Yeah, yeah.
If they lost at home and went 6 points behind, I know it's very early, but how many points did Barcelona drop?
Well, I think they would have looked at this period when Barcelona couldn't play the likes of Turan and Vidal as the time to make up their points. Ivan Rakitic should return from a calf problem. Busquets picked up a knock against England, but should be fit to play. Sergio Ramos should play through a shoulder problem. Keylor Navas missed international duty. Remember, he had that leg injury before. Marca suggests that Navas will not be back in time. Marcelo could be back for Real Madrid. Benzema, hamstring problem. He's been in the headlines as well, as we talked about on the last programme. Isco missed the Spain game with England. Serious injury headaches for both sides, but Bale and James are back.
Yeah, they are. And we saw against Sevilla, didn't we? Sergio Ramos went off injured. They didn't have Keylor Navas. They had Varane and Pepe.
And they just didn't look right.
Didn't. Well, and they conceded 3 poor goals, really. Having been so good defensively under Rafa Benitez since he's come in the summer. So it's a huge test for Real Madrid. And as ever, it's El Clasico. So, you know, managers live and die by their results in that game.
And you've been speaking to Graham Hunter recently about the players that are having to come through the youth system for Barcelona.
Yeah, in particular, because of Messi's absence, the likes of Munir, Sandra have been given their chance, haven't they? The spotlight on that academy again. A club famed for its youth development, of course, with Messi, Xavi, Iniesta, etc., etc. So I asked him whether they need a new star to really come through, because they haven't had one for a number of years, and will they ever get back to having that thing of, you know, 5-6 key players in their side from their academy?
Well, they did. If you could replicate that quality, it would be for their pride, for their emblematic nature, then there would be a benefit. But we should all be clear, and I know you meant this, it's quality based only. It's not let's get the kids through because we are the greatest at developing. It has to be a quality based decision. And at the moment, Sergio Roberto is now advanced in years compared to what you're talking about, but Munir and Sandro are holding their own. Beyond that, I think there's a real question about who's the next guy to come through and establish his place. I think we're going to see a distinct change from the years when there were 6, 7, 8 home-bred players dominating the team.
Graham Hunter speaking to Chris recently. Getafe face Rayo Vallecano in a Madrid derby on Monday too. Chris, great game in Italy in store, a match that Alvaro Morata has called his effective Clasico for the season for Juventus, as his side face AC Milan, 6th against 7th.
Yeah.
This seems to be the iconic, if I think back to watching Italian football in the 90s, the game that I would most look forward to. I mean, what a great fixture this will be on Saturday evening.
It will, and because where they are in the league, it's a vitally important one for... They're both just about in title contention. I don't think AC Milan are going to win the league.
Right.
Juventus, though, have been champions so often recently, and they're just about in it. But if they were to lose and Fiorentina or any of the sides above them won and went 12 points ahead of them, they're currently 9 points back, that is an awfully long way. They have been improving.
Especially as we're now in November and heading... Yeah.
Exactly. You know, they have been improving, 2 wins in a row. Rumours about Paul Pogba, as there is every week. Morata himself, is he going to go back to Madrid? Do they want another striker, etc.? Max Allegri against his former club, of course. So there's wonderful narrative around the game, but it's for two of Italian football's biggest names. It's a massively important game.
Also, Mario Balotelli is going to have hip surgery. Could be out for 1 to 3 months, according to reports. I'm sure Liverpool fans are thinking he's been very quiet in Milan. A huge game, Chris, for 16-year-old Gianluigi Donnarumma. We've talked a lot about the AC Milan goalkeeper. Do you see this as the first big game?
Maybe, but then he's 16, so you have to say his debut was. And he's
right, yeah.
You know, he it's this age-old thing. He didn't come in because of an injury. He came in on selection basis alone.
Yeah, they dropped Diego Lopez. I mean, I just worry if it would be too big a game. You know, But he seems to be handling all this stuff.
Oh, I can look at the other end and see Gigi Buffon. It's the anniversary of his Serie A debut, actually, this week as well. I think it's this week or next week. Buffon, who was basically the same age, so he can look down the pitch and think, if I have a career half as good as Gigi Buffon, I will have done very well.
Well, people are calling him the new Buffon. In Germany, Schalke take on Bayern on Saturday night. That's probably the outstanding fixture from Bundesliga football. Fifth versus first. Dortmund, who are 5 points behind Bayern, face Hamburg on Friday. In France, Chris, Ligue 1 games, as we mentioned at the top of the programme, stand to go ahead at the moment.
Yeah, they're going to go ahead with no away fans due to security concerns in both Ligue 1 and Ligue 2. But I think what we saw at Wembley, as we've discussed, is it's fabulous in a way that football can carry on, and it gives people a chance to get back to some sort of normality and do the things that they love.
Yeah, Paris Saint-Germain away from home this weekend. They take on Lorient. Marseille travel to Saint-Etienne on Sunday night. All of those matches, except the Paris Saint-Germain game, due to its kickoff time for viewers in the UK, are on BT Sport.
This is Football in Europe.
Okay, Chris, time for any other business. Let's turn our attention back to international football. Let's remind listeners of the cancelled games that happened over the Monday-Tuesday period.
Yeah, Belgium against Spain was called off quite early, actually. And then Germany against the Netherlands was called off pretty much, 90 minutes or so?
90 minutes it was, yeah.
Before kickoff. At the time of recording, the reason is major security concerns. I'm sure it was absolutely taken with the public's interest as number one priority.
I think part of the problem with that as well was there were so many conflicting reports about what was happening at the stadium. There was talk of explosives, intent for something at the stadium from police and then from government officials. And so we'll wait and see what happens to that, and we'll talk about that on the next show perhaps. Chris, the Italian national team, how did they get on?
They drew 2-2 with Romania. Florin Andoni with a very late goal in Bologna. I was actually in Bologna at the weekend. Awful planning. Realised, having booked the weekend away, that Italy were playing the day after I left.
In Bologna?
In Bologna.
No!
And as I took off, the airport's quite close to the stadium, I could see the floodlights.
Did you cry a single tear?
I couldn't believe it had happened, to be honest. I'm not sure my girlfriend would have been that up for going, but anyway. But I did see the Romania team wandering around the town centre on Monday. Many were shopping, I can exclusively reveal. Two of them were in Emporio Armani, which I thought, yeah, fair enough. And then I saw six or seven of them walking with footlocker bags.
Don't they get this stuff for free anyway? Yeah. Why are they in a footlocker?
Well, maybe times are hard with the Romanian national team. But they were in their, like, tracksuits, obviously, just wandering around with their footlocker bags, and you're like, oh, newfound respect for the two players that were in Armani.
And if Footlocker would like to sponsor the podcast, please get in touch. Portugal, Chris, you're not happy because on Tuesday night they really decided to test themselves ahead of the European Championships.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, having lost to Russia, they thought, well, we need to step up to see where we are, so they played Luxembourg.
So what's your problem here?
I don't know enough about it, in fairness, but it seems a strange friendly. They won, of course, but Luxembourg got a serious minnows. Great game for them, but is that any sort of a test 7 months out? There's not that much international football between now and the European Championships in France. But they did at least win, having lost, as I said, to Leonard Slutsky's side.
And of course, they have been playing without Ronaldo, who's been busy promoting his film. The other week we spoke to Guillaume Balague, people would have heard that. Well, we saved a little bit back from that interview about what it means for Cristiano Ronaldo to represent his country.
In a reaction that's surprising to many, he tends to put everything in context constantly. That means telling the Portuguese fans that Portugal is a small country, that it's very unlikely they're going to win anything, that just by having him doesn't mean that they will. Like in the World Cup, for instance, he prioritised being with Portugal, even though physically wasn't well, but realised very soon that it was the wrong idea and that if he's not there, the team loses a lot of competitiveness. But having said that, you know, they've been in the European Championship final, semi-final of the World Cup. There's a lot of that happened with Portugal. So it's much more difficult to win with Portugal than it has been with Manchester United or Real Madrid, of course.
Guillaume Balague there on Cristiano Ronaldo. I did watch England against France last night on TV, and I did think it was a pretty solid performance from England overall. You know, and a wonderful goal from Dele Alli. I mean, a slight deflection on the way through, but great for him to score. And he's looking very composed, actually, in that England shirt on that stage. But worrying news for France from that game, because a player we've talked about a lot, Chris Anthony Martial, left on crutches.
Yeah, he did. And they'll have to see if he's fit. Play Watford at the weekend. He's made such an impact since joining from Monaco, and certainly Manchester United will desperately hope that he's okay.
Chris, you commentated on a game as well on Tuesday night.
Yeah, two of the surprise packages from qualifying, really. Iceland and Slovakia, both through to Euro, both amazing years to get there, particularly Iceland, their first ever major championship for Slovakia, their first ever European championship. And Slovakia looked really good. I think they might be the team to avoid in pot three. They have England in the World Cup qualifying campaign. They rested Marek Hamšík, Martin Skrtel, and they won 3-1, came from behind. Iceland had looked really composed going 1-0 up, and then they sort of made a goalkeeping error, fell apart after that. Robert Mack scored twice quickly. Really good win for Slovakia, who are finishing the campaign, or finishing 2015 off with three straight wins. So they'll head into the Euro year, really absolutely bouncing.
But Chris, there's a problem that comes with commentating on Iceland.
Yeah, well, there aren't many surnames in Iceland. There aren't many people in Iceland. This is, you know, this is the great thing about their qualifying. 329,000, the smallest nation ever to qualify wow. for a World Cup or a Euro. Easily the smallest nation. 10 times as many people live in Wales. It does mean that often you'll have two players with the same surname, or, for example, one player went off injured, called Sigurd Jonsson, and in the second half, another Sigurd Jonsson came on, which is...
Different bloke, or...?
Different bloke can be a little bit of a, you know, you tend to panic a little when you're commentating anyway, and then you see the same person coming on, and obviously it's not. There is that moment when you think, oh, I do hope that I called it right in the first place.
Chris, give me the thumbs up if we're all done.
We're done.
Good news. Join us next Monday for our special review of El Clasico. Chris, we're going to watch that at my house, are we?
Yeah, it should be brilliant.
If you're enjoying the podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes and follow us on Audioboom.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.